first case on the Southern Panel's oral argument docket today is Thomas versus District Court, case number 69074. Ms. Forsman, Mr. Sutter, welcome both. Thank you. Proceed.
Brandon Forsman, on behalf of Lacey Thomas, the petitioner in this case, Your Honor, if it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. From the deliberate injection of race into the grand jury proceedings to the prosecutor-caused mistrial in this case in which Thomas had called out for some judicial limitation on the powers of the state, both issues that we presented here in this petition implicate that call. This case, and let me start with the double jeopardy issue, is that unlike the many Brady violation cases that this court sees, there are two very distinguishing factors in this case. The first is that usually what you hear is that the withheld discovery or the undisclosed discovery, the DA didn't know about it, it's over at the police department, everybody's arguing cause versus Whitney, saying they had constructive knowledge of it, but you don't have that here. What you have here is testimony by the detectives on the case that Detective Ford said he talked to Mr. Mitchell, who is not here and was not at the evidentiary hearing. He talked to Mr. Mitchell, the lead prosecutor at that time, dozens of times, and each time he talked to him about the investigation, and he talked to him about the documents which were the subject of the mistrial, which were the undisclosed documents that were the subject of the mistrial. In fact, at the end of the evidentiary hearing, that is exactly the finding that was made by the district court judge. He found that when Mr. Mitchell protested at the time that the mistrial was declared, well, I've never seen these documents. He must have found that he didn't believe that, because he credited Detective Ford's testimony where he said clearly, we gave it to him, we talked to him about it, because this is what happened.
Is it your view that every time you have a Brady violation that the district attorney knew about the documents and made the incorrect call, arguably deliberately, that a mistrial premised on that Brady violation constitutes a double jeopardy violation, invalidating and requiring dismissal of all counts?
Well, I think it's going to be rare that you're going to have a case where the district attorney is going to send in and say I did it on purpose.
Right, but let's say we have that. Let's say we have an intentional Brady violation.
If you have an intentional Brady violation and this court upholds a finding of intentional Brady violation, then yes, double jeopardy is implicated. There's meaning to double jeopardy. It means that they don't get to do that.
So the penalty is the charges are, there's a mistrial and retrial cannot be had on any of the charges. So it adds a new layer to the Brady violation.
It does, if that's what occurs. That's not usually what you have, as you know. Usually what you have is the evidence is discovered after the trial. Okay.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I understand that, but I'm trying to understand your rule that you're advocating.
If under Hylton, if what you find that it was inexcusable negligence, and obviously an intentional and deliberate violation of Brady would come under the, well, if it comes under the rule of inexcusable negligence, I suppose there could be an explanation. The prosecutor could say, well, I misread the law. You know, okay, if he said I misread the law, then it wouldn't fall under Hylton. And it wouldn't, you could find an excuse, even for a deliberate violation.
You take the position that Nevada has thrown in with the state courts that have decided to depart from Oregon versus Kennedy, and I understand reading Hylton why you say that, but it's a very unconscious choice according to the opinions that we've written. Melcher and Hylton both, at least Melcher, cites Oregon without any hesitation that the Godey win the mistrial.
They do.
And Oregon applies, and then Hylton just sort of goes past it.
Hylton makes it, I think, the most explicit because it defines the question in Hylton, which is,
it doesn't say we're not throwing in with the U.S. Supreme Court in Oregon. I mean,
No, and none of our opinions in Nevada have explicitly done that. I think that you have to be able to count on what the court says the question is, even if you haven't explicitly spelled out.
Confusing, we've expressed it.
I'm sorry?
No matter how confusing we've expressed it.
Well, it's the only way that us practitioners can figure out what the law is.
To follow on to Justice Pickering's question, though, and I understand, of course, your advocacy on behalf of your client in this particular case, but looking at the law generally, what should be an opinion in this case in reconciling, if needed, the Kennedy case with the analytics contained in the Gloria and Heilton case for the test here, because this is a case where that could make a difference. There really are two different tests. Kennedy says, how will you goad it into a mistrial? It begs that question, and factually, I'm not clear. I'm going to ask you to comment on that. And then secondly, is this a case of excusable negligence or inexcusable negligence? The test in Heilton maybe makes this case easier to understand or easier to apply it to the facts of this case. But if you look at what they did in Kennedy, the test is entirely different. It might produce a different result depending upon whether you were goaded or not into this trial.
Justice, I think I would agree with that it could make a difference. The test that I would suggest to you, and we've laid it out in the courts that have explicitly moved away from the Kennedy rule, and basically based upon a concurring opinion, which it says this is an impossible test to meet, that you will never protect a defendant's double jeopardy rights under these circumstances. If what the defendant is required to do is to get a prosecutor to come in and say, I meant to do it.
Here you've got that it's goaded into a mistrial. The object in Kennedy is whether or not the prosecutor's misconduct, call it misconduct just so we can discuss it, whether the prosecutor's misconduct goaded the defense into moving for a mistrial, and therefore that motion by the defense should not preclude the defendant from claiming double jeopardy. So there is nothing in this Brady violation that I can see that was directed at provoking the defendant to file a mistrial negligently, intentionally, in any way. The intentionality was with respect to withholding the ACS evidence.
It was pretty close, though, I have to tell you. That case was going very, very badly for the prosecution. In fact, it was going so badly that the district court judge, after the trial, said, you haven't proven this case. This is not a crime. I'm dismissing this case. Now, we've got, obviously, some confusion with regard to then what happened with the state's appeal. But this case was going very, very badly. You do not have the prosecutor saying, well, they better ask for a mistrial because we didn't give them the documents. No, but what you do have is very close to Heilton because of the testimony of the detectives. And the detectives said, we talked to him about it, and we told him it was exculpatory because the cops didn't believe that count 1 and count 6 should be charged. That's how that testimony comes out. So they go back to Mr. Mitchell. Detective Hood even says, we made a second copy, and this is the binder. We made a second copy of the binder because once we understood they actually indicted those counts after we talked to Mr. Campbell and after we knew all the documents that were exculpatory with regard to ACS, so we went back to them. So you have notice after notice. But I think the
Brady violation is intentional, okay? But I'm just concerned about the test. I'm harkening back a bit to what Justice Hardiston said and whether it has to be tied to provoking a defendant into a mistrial or not.
Well,
if I can restate the question from my perspective, following on what Justice Pickering said, and I'm inviting both counsel to comment on this. If this panel believes that the better test is the one that has been articulated in Heilton, because Heilton doesn't really discuss the U.S. Supreme Court's approach, in writing an opinion in this case, how would one articulate the distinction and why the deviation, because one could reasonably expect this would be something that would end up as a cert petition where the conflict in the test would be evaluated by the U.S. Supreme Court if they took it. So how would we explain our position in deviating from what they did in Kennedy?
Well, I think you have a lot of friends in other states that have done that, and basically what they have done is to take the concurring opinion and said, we have more honor for the double jeopardy clause, particularly with the facts of this case. When we look at the purposes of the double jeopardy clause, nothing could be more clear that this case is one that they would have wanted to protect.
So you would urge us to write an opinion that says we have more honor for the double jeopardy clause than the U.S. Supreme Court justices?
That's exactly right. I don't think we should make suggestions that language. I don't want to be up there in front of them.
We might be putting you in that position, Mr. Sonner.
Okay. But I do think that if you, again, not explicitly, but if you read those opinions from other states, that's what they're saying, is that we are not going to create an impossible test for a defendant to meet when there has been a deliberate violation or an inexcusably neglectful conduct that has caused a defendant to go through 10 days of trial and actually 7 years of litigation when the biggest distinguishing factor in this case is they didn't offer any excuse. They offered no excuse.
They argued and avoided the mistrial double jeopardy by saying, fine, we'll dismiss the ACS count?
They actually asked at trial when Judge Maloney was getting ready to do the mistrial, can we just proceed on the other counts? Judge Maloney's finding at that point was no. Because the prejudice has infected the entire trial, and so there's no way to separate
that. That's a good segue. One of the areas that I am concerned about in this matter is how the double jeopardy would apply to the remaining counts. Could you go into that?
I think it's really straightforward.
It was illegal.
It's very straightforward. It's in the Hanley case. And that's the legal error that the trial court made, which is that the court said, well, jeopardy didn't attach to the remaining counts because this material only had to do with count one. Well, one, count six is still there, and count six still has to do with ACS, and count six still implicates all of the issues that count one did. But the other part is that jeopardy attaches at the time the jury is sworn. Otherwise, it's meaningless. You can't break off the counts in order to salvage the prejudice that you've already imposed on the defendant.
Okay.
May I reserve my remaining time for
you? Yes, of course. Are there any other questions before she does? All right. Thank you. Yes, sir.
May it please the court, I understand the comments that have been questions that have been posed by the court to counsel. I'll try to address some of those as we go forward. I guess one of the issues, main issue it looks upon is what the court is focused on, at least today, appears to be the issue of whether there was a
violation.
I still think that, and before I get to the argument, I just want to take just one brief period to address this issue. This court, nor the district court, ever went back and looked at the charging document in this case, other than when the court made its ruling in the original petition that was brought up, or the original appeal that was brought up.
I was going to say, I read it pretty thoroughly.
Again, that count one never made the allegation that no work was done by ACS. The court figured that out, this court. The district court never addressed that issue, even though we argued it constantly. The book itself only showed that ACS was doing work, meaning in the sense of having meetings and so forth to try and raise the revenue coming into to UMC Hospital. Because that's what the evidence showed, and there's nothing to show that it did anything other than to show that they did work, and because the allegation related to why there was a violation was premised on the fact that no work was done, the two didn't match. We never alleged no work was done in count one, We always said work was done. The testimony before the grand jury said work was done. The audit that was in evidence, even at the grand jury and discussed with the grand jury, said work was done by ECS. So a book coming in at trial, intentional, unintentional, whether it happened in what way, really does not matter in the sense that it doesn't go to negate any of the charges in the charging document, let alone count one, which was ultimately dismissed by this court. So that being said, a violation where there is a discovery violation, which the court has deemed to be a Brady violation, I still have a hard time, the state all has a hard time determining how that book, in looking at count one, in any way shows that ACS was either, at least Mr. Thomas, through ACS, the ACS contract, either didn't do what he was alleged to have done, or exonerates him or shows something beneficial to him. It just isn't there. The count, we've been years since
I... Well, maybe it isn't there from the state's perspective, but if the defense doesn't have it, they don't get to formulate an argument and develop a theory about how it can be used. So I don't know that that's a saving grace for this issue. I think it would be best maybe to focus on the fact that the judge has said it's a Brady violation. It certainly appears to be. I appreciate your explanation and your viewpoint, but let's see how it applies from that point going forward.
I think Justice Pickering has pointed out a very important point, and I would go back to both of what you have said here today in the sense of looking at Kennedy, looking at Hylton, looking at cases that fall around those two cases to see, okay, should there be these standards set? Is there something more stringent that Nevada needs to have in place than what was delineated by the Supreme Court and Kennedy?
I don't even see in the state's brief that you asked us to revisit Hylton and overrule it.
No.
Do you do that?
No, we have not, and I'm not suggesting that...
So does the state concede that the test in Nevada, at least, is adequately expressed constitutionally in Hylton?
I believe so.
Okay.
And here is the issue. I do not believe that Hylton is counter to or much in the way of different than what was decided by the Supreme Court in Kennedy. Kennedy said that it lays out that it has to be intentional conduct or the like, but it also specifically says that the conduct could not have been intended to provoke a mistrial. I think that if conduct is proffered by the state, by the prosecuting arm, to elicit it or provoke a mistrial, then that leads us to the analysis, the tests that Hylton laid out, which basically put out that there needs to be three parts here. The defense consents, and typically it's not a bar. However, if there is something that the state did intentionally to goad, to cause, to overreach, to harass the defendant into asking for that mistrial, then it really doesn't apply. If we take this next step where the court finds that it's manifest necessity, which the court did here to declare the mistrial, that still doesn't prevent the state from losing if, in fact, there is intentional conduct that is aimed at causing a mistrial.
Counsel, is the Hylton conduct aimed at causing a mistrial? I have trouble seeing that linkage in that opinion.
In Hylton?
Yes.
Well, I believe that the language...
I think goading is a strong verb, but in Hylton, although we don't affirmatively or explicitly repudiate the Oregon case, we do this without reference to whether or not the object of the misconduct was to provoke a motion for mistrial by the defense.
My reading of Hylton, and I even wrote it down so that I could make sure that I would address it correctly, is that in the sense that manifest necessity one, we've eliminated that, if there was manifest necessity or prosecution is responsible for, in some way for causing this trial, which is usually the case. My reading was that it went one step further to say, did the prosecution intend to provoke a mistrial? And did it overreach? Did it harass? Did it engage in any kind of conduct which would be anger, or that being the ultimate goal. And I think the whole purpose of Kennedy, Hylton, all of the other cases is trying to say, look, the state doesn't get to come in, and when things are looking bad, and I would dispute whether the trial was going bad or not, but when things are not going well for the state, that the state can go, okay, let's just do something to cause the defense or the court to essentially declare mistrial, so we get a do-over.
Counsel, how can you say that Justice Sotomayor wants to speak?
Counsel, in your example, notwithstanding that you've, I think, conceded that Hylton doesn't require this first step that Kennedy does, how then would anyone fulfill the criteria that you're laying out? What situation would we ever be able to find the type of violation that Hylton says we need to be looking for in this situation?
Well, I think every one of these cases, and I think the one thing that Kennedy does to win to Hylton in the answer to your question is that it's a very fact and case-specific determination.
If not here, as when?
Well, would the court like me to address the specific facts of this case, then? Because here,
you can do both in your answer, I presume.
Okay. In this particular situation, we have the state, rightly or wrongly, did not have the documents in its possession. We had actually gone back after this issue came up. We looked at our records. We didn't have them. I provided the information to the court, which we had the logs of what we had available from the police that the police had brought over. It wasn't contained there. So at least at the time of trial, the state did not have possession of it. How it became over, if it came over, because both detectives at the evidentiary hearing said they did. Detective Ford said he believed he would have provided it, that he probably did provide it. Neither one of the detectives said that they remember actually giving it to the state.
Okay, so assuming that you had it in your custody for purposes of my question.
Okay. So assume that we have it in the possession of the state. So there is a document, there is a binder that contains information that shows that a defendant does work in this particular case. At the time, well, I can't go through that argument because it assumes that we didn't have it, but the document itself would then have to be viewed by the state as being exculpatory for us to have an affirmative obligation to make sure that the defense was aware of it and had it. And if in fact we make that determination, then I agree with you that if we have something in our possession that we believe shows that it negates or drives away from a charge or shows that somebody's innocent or not guilty of the crimes charged, that we have an obligation, an affirmative obligation, to provide that to the defense, or at least make it accessible to them.
Could I clarify one fact, though? My understanding from the record is that Detective Whitley could not recall whether the documents were given to the district attorney's office. But Detective Ford, at pages 350 through 52, 355, 361, and 364 of the record, said that he gave the documents to the district attorney in charge of the case, Mitchell, and discussed the documents with him, and later said, also at page 351 of the record, he recommended not charging Thomas with the ACS counts.
That is absolutely true that he said he...
So one of the detectives did testify he gave these documents to the DA's office, right?
I believe he would have. His also testimony at 363 and 364 says, the question was, do you actually remember giving Don Campbell materials to Scott Mitchell? His answer was, no, I don't. He also was asked or said he had no recollection of ever providing that material to Scott Mitchell in the original submission. So those were things he was saying, whether he believed he probably would have because they provided it, but he had no specific recollection of doing so. So getting back to Justice Saeed's question, assuming that the book is there, we have to make a determination that it is.
Well, we have a factual finding by the district court that there was a Brady violation because the evidence adduced at the evidentiary hearing showed that the binder was given to the DA's office by the police. That's a finding of fact.
Yes.
And there's evidence to support that fact finding. Would you agree?
I would agree based on the detective's testimony.
We have to work with that factual finding.
Okay. Again, and this is the reason why I began this process with what the court did not want me to focus on was if the book is in our possession, constructively, whatever, we've got it, we don't turn it over, or it doesn't get turned over, it gets lost, whatever happens to it, it's not in our physical possession at the time of trial. When we find out about it is actually 3 days after the defense actually had it in their possession. So he finds out about it, Mr. Albrecht finds out about it, and actually has it on Tuesday of trial. This comes up on Thursday of trial. Friday is when we come back showing that I showed him the documentation showing we didn't have it, and that it was not in our possession, we didn't have any inventory of it at all. But having it, not having it, doesn't mean that we're not responsible, obviously. However, in looking at the book, even to this day, in light of what we charged, I do not believe that any reasonable person can look at that and deem it exculpatory. It would have been something, and I agree with the court, that maybe somebody could look upon it as useful to their case, but it wouldn't have been something that would have stood out to me, or stood out to, I believe, Mr. Mitchell at the time, and said, gosh, this really undermines count one. We need to make sure that they are aware of us and have it. It wouldn't have been something, even to this day, that I would say that in light of the language in count one, which has been dismissed, and referring count six, which refers to count one. So that's what most of the
is done. Because the legal point, let's say that we disagree with you, and I'm not saying that we do, I'm just hypothesizing. Let's say we disagree with you. We think it was an intentional brain violation by the state. Does that satisfy Hylton when a mistrial is premised on that Brady violation?
I would say no.
Tell me why. What is the test?
The test would be looking at a case and focus specific thing, how the violation occurred, at least from the evidentiary hearing, and if it was intentional, what was the ultimate result? I mean, what happened?
Was the object of the recording? Because to me, I'm asking you to assume there was an intentional Brady violation.
Okay, I'll assume that.
Does that automatically, under Hylton, if it comes up during trial and provokes a motion for mistrial from the defense that's granted, does that automatically mean there's a double jeopardy precludes the second trial? And if not, why not? What are you advocating?
You can say it blanketly. Because I think it's important to know whatever the intentional violation was. If it was something where there was, it's hard to come up with an example of how you can have an intentional act. I think in most cases, if there was an intentional act, maybe I should take it this way. If there was an intentional act to withhold information that was truly exculpatory for a defendant, I would say that would be a double jeopardy bar.
Okay.
But that is something that I could see. I don't think that that's what we have here, and for a number of reasons. I mean, in fact, not only did counsel have it, but when this first comes up at trial, he says in the argument, I wasn't deprived of this. I'm not saying that I didn't have access. I didn't have, he made those comments at the outset. He had it for 3 days. If this had been something that he gets and he goes, oh my God, this is a violation. Day eight, which is the day that this comes up, nowhere in there does he ever say, this is a violation such that I need a mistrial. It's only after we get to the next day when he's had a chance. He's had a chance to think about it, but then we finally hear the issues of mistrial coming up. Because Scott Mitchell on that eighth day, on Thursday, the day before, even raises this issue. He goes, well, hold on, I don't know if he's saying he was deprived of it. And he says, no, I wasn't. I wasn't deprived of it because he got it through his own due diligence.
Counsel, in the middle of trial, day three or four, whatever you've just cited, in the middle of trial, you think that's adequate? I mean, I think that's what Brady is all about. It's to provide advance notice in order to prepare for trial or to defend against charges. I can't imagine that you're actually suggesting that just because someone had something mid-trial and they took a couple days to digest it, that makes it okay.
No, I'm not saying it's okay if it is a truly exculpatory document. I think we have two different things here that we're discussing. One, a document that is not is truly exculpatory, and one where it is deemed at least by the prosecution, but it is not. If there is an intentional withholding of truly exculpatory, then I agree with you. Double jeopardy should bar. I don't think there's any out for that. However, in many cases, and I would say that unfortunately every case that comes before the court, and the reason why it needs to be fact-specific and why Kennedy says this is a narrowly drawn exception as far as the loading issue, that if, in fact, there is a fact-specific determination and there's any leeway that can be given to the state in the sense of we don't have the document, it's not that we had it and we didn't give it to them, we didn't physically have it in our possession. How that occurred, I cannot tell the court. However, that means that it was not an intentional on our part failure to disclose because it wasn't in the materials we had. It could have been a negligent, I wouldn't say gross negligent, but a negligent failure by something being lost because the voluminous materials in this case are quite large. But there were other avenues for the counsel to get this document besides the release. He was aware of the civil litigation that had been going on and was going on at the time of his trial. That's how he got it. He went to Mr. Campbell and he talked to him. He had access to that information. He had said when talking about Detective Lawton and Detective Ford and the documents themselves, he says that access to the discovery, to the documents, has never been an issue. He says, and I quote, this is Mr. Albrecht, the heart of the constitutional issue is that the documents didn't give notice to him. I mean, at least not the documents. The charging document did not give notice to him. He either comes forward and says that because I didn't have this document, I was somehow deprived of my right to a fair trial, and here we are years and years down the road, and there's not been a single thing which Judge Belani was concerned about. I mean, further investigation, further discovery, further information that could have come from that document, there's been nothing that's come forward and said, in fact, that there has been anything discovered, there has been anything new that's come. We're left with the same document that says work was done by ACS.
I don't know if my colleagues have any additional questions, but I do have one that I'd like you to address maybe in a minute or so. What's the state's view about how this court should approach the application of the double jeopardy argument in this case to the remaining counts? We don't really have any Nevada case that is considered the application to different counts that raise factually, potentially very different allegations of criminal activity.
I think that if there was an intentional act by the state to cause a mistrial, as is delineated in the cases, that would apply to all charges. I do not, however, think that if a judge, for whatever reason, rules that there for manifest necessity, whether a court later on determines that or not, or a defendant asks for it, and it's not clear from the record that there was a goading or intentional act on the part to force from the state to force a mistrial, that and it only related to one or two counts, that although I would agree with counsel that jeopardy attaches at the time that a jury is sworn to all counts, that it would prevent retrial on those counts, this whole issue never addressed in the first place.
Okay.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Yes, of course.
How would you articulate that rule if you were running with them?
With the premise that jeopardy attaches to all counts?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Can I continue?
Yes.
With the premise that jeopardy attaches to all counts at the outset, and a judge rules, as I said, for whatever reason, or defendants, or whatever, if it is shown at an evidentiary hearing or later by this court or some sort of secondary process that, in fact, it was erroneous for the judge to have decided that on that one issue based on whatever the issues were before the court at that time, then I do not believe that it would apply to the other counts. I'm at a little bit of a loss to actually draft in my head right now a rule that you could utilize in the future, but I think that one of the reasons I come back to the Kennedy case and the program there about it being a narrowly tailored sort of look at when you can and cannot come back because of double jeopardy, but they did not want things too broad. And you have to, and because there's nothing, either every fact-specific situation that comes up is going to be different. They'll be dealing with similar things, but they're going to be different. And because of that, I think you have to look at each individual case and say, what did we have? What did the prosecutors have? What did the defense have? How did this cause a mistrial? And if so, was it so tainting that it would affect the other counts with nothing to do with the other?
Do you have a case law that supports applying this just as to the tainted count?
No.
I don't understand. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Justice Seda, did you have any additional questions?
I do not.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Clerk, please add 2 minutes to Ms. Forsman's argument time as we added some time to the estates.
Thank you, Mayor. All of the issues with regard to whether this was Brady, whether diligence was exercised, all of that, the state chose not to do what it has done a number of times, that recess that trial and come up to this court and say the judge is wrong about this. Don't let him allow this mistrial to go forward. They didn't do that. Because the remedy now, as opposed to post-conviction cases, it's quite different in post-conviction cases. The trial is over and you can do whatever you want to do. But you can't go back and say, well, the judge was wrong. It isn't Brady. Because it's what he found at the time of the grand jury mistrial that it was Brady. I do want to correct a couple of things. And one is, Mr. Stoddard represented to you that he went to the office and they looked at logs and all this sort of thing. This is what he said in the trial court. First of all, he said, I don't know whether we've gotten them or not. And then he said that Detectives Whiteley and Floyd very easily could have provided stuff that got lost in our office. Now, is that excusable neglect? We don't know. Because I think going back to the test, which is the thing that we're grappling with, if it's an intentional violation, if in fact what Mr. Stoddard was talking about had occurred, where you've got somebody, Detective Ford says he's met with Scott Mitchell a number of times, and that he doesn't understand why counts 1 and 6 got charged, so he came back with a second bulletin of the stuff to talk to Scott Mitchell, all of that's unrefuted. If Mr. Mitchell took the stand and said, well, I didn't think it was Brady. And that's why I didn't turn it over. You could probably at that point, and the trial court could probably at that point assess that as they did in Milkman Bayard, and mitigating things about what the prosecutor did that would allow them to come up with a different result. And we don't have that here because they chose, and Mr. Stoddard, the state has not in its brief or anywhere else said why they chose to do that, why they chose not to offer any explanation. I think that the state of discovery issues in Nevada is a warning, and it is a warning when it gets to federal court. And of course, I've seen a lot of that because we did the post-conviction stuff. And the only way it's going to stop is for this court to say, you just can't do this, and put a man like Lacey Thomas through this. That's what the double jeopardy clause is about. And when you ask whether or not you can carve off the rest of the counts, that's the reason the test is that jeopardy attaches at the time. It gives you a clear line. There is no case authority. We don't have case authority for what they're suggesting. I've gone through every law review article on this, every case I could find on this, and no court says, oh, even though all of the counts were tried and the state chose to try all of the counts at once, and even though they did that, we'll stay, if you put witnesses on 1.5 of the counts or 2 of the counts, then we can proceed on the rest. That's not how double jeopardy works, because that's counter to the purposes of double jeopardy. I have to say something about the second issue, even though I know the focus of this court. I want to say one thing about the easiest place to find what the nature of this material is the, and it sort of relates to the second count. Counts one, almost all of the counts have an allegation and a theory underlying them that the contracts which Mr. Thomas entered into with these vendors were not of value because there were other folks doing the work at UMC. Not very well, but there were other folks doing the work at UMC. So that was true of count one. And Don Campbell testified that the ACS, that this binder included all of these meetings, and it rebutted the false allegations that were lodged by Mr. Carroll, the auditor with UMC, who testified in the trial. So it's really a question that it was exculpatory. These accounts also led to the state's other theory, which was that there were modifications to the contract, all of which were approved, by the way, all the way up to the county commission, that there were modifications to the contract, and these documents show meeting after meeting after meeting with how this company was struggling to be able to meet its obligation under the contract. That's why the county lost when ACS sued them. And got $500,000 for the money that it hadn't been paid. This case needs to be put out of its misery.
I have a question for you. It's just analytical, but you say there's a difference in post-conviction. Let's say none of this came to light until there was a conviction, and you have the Brady violation comes out then, and then you have the exact same record. Your point is that it could be retried at that point, and there would not be a double jeopardy violation associated with that. Is what I heard you say. Is that what you're saying?
I misspoke. I think if you find, because we're not using that test when we're post-conviction. I think what I'm saying is that cases which are presented to you are usually in a post-conviction posture. But I think you would have exactly the same argument that if it was intentional, if it was inexcusable, if they offered no excuse for it, that the double jeopardy clause would.
I don't understand your position.
Yeah, I think it's not usually
the
question.
You're talking about the remedy.
I'm sorry?
You're talking about the remedy,
right,
as opposed to the analytics,
right,
in the post-conviction context that would lead you to that discussion. If you were in post-conviction, I'm sure any lawyer who's doing that is going to be arguing for the remedy you're arguing now.
I think that's true. I think that's
so
true.
The breadth of the rule is that great, that if there is an intentional knowing,
there would be no reason for the rule to depart from that if that were the factual circumstance.
But it is untethered from building the mistrial.
Well, it is because you're not providing that test when it hasn't been a mistrial, correct? Thank you.
Which may be another reason why Kennedy has a weakness.
It could be. It could be.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Justice Sadu, did you have any additional questions for Ms. Forsman?
I do not.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, then. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments here today and your briefing. The case will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess until 11:30.